Welcome to the very first Tech Policy Podcast, your source for policy raves and rants from Tech Freedom, your Washington, D.C. advocate for the freedom to tinker and innovate. I'm Evan Schwartztreiber, your host. Now, there are many reasons why you may be listening to this. You're a nerd, you got an email from my mother, you have nothing better to listen to. But however you got here, we're just happy to have you. As this is our first episode, you might be wondering who we are and what we do. On today's show, we'll tell you. My guest is founder and president of Tech Freedom, Baron Soka, and he might just have something to say about it. So, Baron, what is Tech Freedom, and why should anyone care?
Well, it's a DC think tank dedicated to lowercase t, lowercase f, tech freedom. That's a very common concept. You may hear that term in the tech world, but certainly you hear people talking about it all the time. It's the idea that the government really shouldn't be telling people what they can and can't do on the internet with new technologies without very good reasons. Our work really is to balance the needs of law enforcement with privacy, the needs of consumers and consumer protection with the advantages that come from innovation, and to be a voice in general for saying that the government's role should be as narrow as possible and that we should be careful about interfering with new ways of doing things that people in Washington or state capitals don't really understand.
So if we had to sum up tech freedom and with a couple of terms, would it be accurate to say permissionless innovation and regulatory humility?
Yes. It's almost as if you're the communications director for Tech Freedom.
Well, now that you've spoiled the surprise, I'll go to my next question. How long have you been think tanking?
I've been doing this since 2007. I practiced internet law before that. I joined the Progress and Freedom Foundation, which had been the original tech policy think tank, started back in 1993. PFF was best known for its IP work, unfortunately. That's all that most people really knew it for. It also did telecom work and some very good media freedom, free speech work. I joined to launch a larger internet policy program and worked with Adam Thier, who had been doing that media freedom, free speech work. And together we expanded PFF's work into many of the areas that Tech Freedom is now known for. But Tech Freedom launched in 2011 to continue that work, minus some of the baggage that PFF had. And that was really two things. One, PFF, as I said, was known almost exclusively for its IP work. We don't do that.
And when you say IP, you mean intellectual property, copyright, trademark, etc.?
Right, exactly. Patents and so on. Mainly copyright. And second, we do civil liberties work. It's a core part of our mission. We've been spending a lot of the last 5 years on privacy, on surveillance, on law enforcement, access to data. Those were things that, of course, started during the Bush administration. The Patriot Act and other reactions to 9/11 were major problems that happened during the Bush administration that the free market movement in particular didn't really say much about. And so our goal is to really marry work on economic freedoms and also social freedoms.
So we have a sense of the mission of the organization, but have you actually accomplished anything?
Well, it's hard to accomplish much in DC. It's true that not a lot gets done, and a big part of our mission really is simply to push back. A lot of that feels like pushing the boulder up the hill, as the old myth goes. But I would point to a few specific accomplishments. Last summer, Congress did pass major reforms to the Patriot Act, and that was really the result of many years of pushing by a broad coalition of groups across the political spectrum that included us. We were organizing for many years, many of the free market, libertarian, conservative groups, in trying to strike a better balance. And the USA Freedom Act largely reflects that. It's not the bill that we would have written, but it's certainly an improvement. And I would take some credit for that, along with other groups, and also take credit for building a coalition that really does span the political spectrum. And now you hear that law being debated, for example, in the Republican primaries. And you see Rand Paul and Ted Cruz standing up for USA Freedom and against the hawkish wing of the party. And they're reflecting ideas that we and a few other groups in the free market movement have been pushing.
Yeah, and you see a similar dynamic on the Democratic side where Bernie Sanders would probably share a lot of our values when it comes to civil liberties, but someone like Hillary Clinton is a little bit more hawkish. So it's interesting to see on both sides of the political spectrum this debate going on, especially in the wake of the Paris attacks, privacy versus security. And the USA Freedom Act is one of the few tech issues that really has made it into the race. And the debate between Rubio and Cruz is sure to get more intense as, assuming Donald Trump phases out, then those two are really going to be going at it.
Well, indeed, we did work very closely with Senator Sanders' office on USA Freedom. And I've been very saddened, but not surprised, to hear some hand-waving from Hillary Clinton on issues like encryption, dismissing concerns about the First Amendment, etc. That's unfortunate. It's not very different from what you hear from, say, a Marco Rubio or a Jeb Bush.
Yeah, it's definitely concerning when the First Amendment is a throwaway line. I think we would say it's a little bit more important than that. But so USA Freedom, that's a feather in your cap. What else would you like to point to?
Well, similarly in that vein, we've spent the last 5.5 years pushing for reforms to the law that governs email access. We've been part of a coalition that insists that law enforcement should have to get a warrant if they want to access the email that you have stored in the cloud, just as they would if you were storing that email on your home computer. That's a basic Fourth Amendment value. That would require amending the 1986 law, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. That's a reform that's now supported by over 300 members of the House, people from both parties. We've helped to push that, and we're now trying to see that across the finish line to overcome resistance in the Senate from regulators, some of the same regulators that we criticize in much of our work on regulatory policy. So I would point to that as a success, only a partial one. Obviously, we haven't actually gotten it through yet, but it is another example of building that big tent.
Yeah, and privacy advocates might say, you know, the Fourth Amendment applies to the papers in your desk. Why shouldn't the same warrant protections apply to the emails in the cloud? I think the government would say that, you know, you really don't have an expectation of privacy on the internet. The privacy is dead. Everyone's posting things on Facebook and Twitter, and that, you know, it's just irresponsible for you to think that those Fourth Amendment protections should extend to the digital age. What would you say to that?
I would say what the Supreme Court said back in U.S. v. Jones, which is that increasingly everything is moving into the cloud. And if we don't extend the Fourth Amendment there, the Fourth Amendment really will have no meaning in the future.
Well, it's good to see that email privacy reform has such a large number of co-sponsors in the House, and hopefully we'll get some movement in the Senate. So USA Freedom, email privacy, what else would you like to brag about?
I mentioned a very partial victory. The CISA, the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act, as many people know, has been debated for years. It finally was passed as part of a much larger bill that just had to be passed by Congress. That's not a success, but there was one small but important success in there. There is a provision in the final version that at least says that, yes, the bill will immunize private companies when they share information with each other or the government, which potentially could include sensitive personal information, but at least that provision won't nullify a private contract or terms of service that a service might make in order to promise its users that it's going to be more privacy protective, that it might remove personal information before it shares it with the government or other private companies. That's an idea that we and the Competitive Enterprise Institute alone really had been pushing consistently for the last few years, and I'm just glad to see that that part at least got into the bill. It certainly will do a lot to address some of the perhaps more serious implications of the bill.
Yeah, and considering that the bill got slipped into a budget bill kind of at the 11th hour, which happens with a lot of unpopular things in Washington, I'm sure that some of the more privacy-minded members of the House are going to be looking at this bill because, as a lot of privacy advocates have said, it's a surveillance bill really dressed up as cybersecurity. Anything else you'd like to point to?
Just finally, I'd point to our success in moving the conversation towards making broadband deployment easier. A lot of what we do revolves around the assumption that broadband deployment isn't adequate, there isn't enough competition, and yet for years, nobody's really wanted to do anything about that, except to suggest that the government should build and own broadband networks. And what you're seeing now is, in both parties, people are actually talking about the underlying problem, which is why it's so hard for new companies to enter the market, like Google Fiber. And those issues are somewhat about the federal government and access to federal assets, but largely about state and local governments. And you're finally seeing legislation that will at least make it somewhat easier, even if it's not going to fully address the problem.
One of the points that Tech Freedom's been making is that there's been so much hand-wringing for over a decade over the issue of net neutrality. What most Americans really care about is getting better service, faster speeds, more options, and the amorphous notion that all internet traffic be treated the same and that the government and the FCC have to police the internet really seems like a distraction from what the real issue should be, which is broadband deployment.
Well, it's worse than a distraction. The FCC, in its quest to assert authority here, has opened the door to some very nasty things. For example, nobody's paid attention to this, but reinterpreting what a telecommunications service is under the Communications Act for regulatory purposes also opens the door for the FCC to regulate those telecommunications services, that is, all internet services, under a 1992 law that would ban encryption, that would make it a requirement for services to be wiretap ready. That's a very serious consequence. It's not hard to see a Rubio administration using that, or Trump FCC for certain. But you've also seen some other examples of this where companies like T-Mobile, which have offered very innovative services that help attract new consumers. Binge On, for example, offers free video. They're being attacked now for violating the FCC's rules. And in a very technical sense, those attacks have some merit. The rules are written in a way that could actually make those obviously pro-consumer services illegal.
So it seems like the bottom line is that the regulations might have been intended to protect quote-unquote net neutrality, but really they're going to have some adverse impacts. And when you start to stare down the prospect of a ban on encryption, it seems like the unintended consequences are really becoming clearer.
Or billions of dollars in new broadband taxes.
Exactly. So we've talked about a lot of issues that might be unfamiliar to our listeners. What's the point? Why should the average person care about tech policy and the work that we do? We've got the State of the Union coming up tonight, and tech is kind of an afterthought. Can you explain to our listeners why this all matters?
Yeah, increasingly, these issues are permeating every other issue we deal with. They're no longer a discrete set of issues like farm policy or foreign policy. They're really part of everyone's life. And that's obviously true given how integrated all these services are in what you do day to day, whether it's taking an Uber or using a new technology like drones. We're all using these services more and more. And I think that anytime you go home, talk to your family, say over the holidays, you're seeing these conversations become more and more part of American political discourse. It's certainly been true in the primaries on both sides.
So you've been think tanking now for 5 years. We've seen you in the news, op-eds, congressional testimony. Why a podcast and why start one now?
Well, I'm a big fan of podcasting. Everyone else here at Tech Freedom is too. And it's a way for us to give ourselves a voice, to communicate with people in a more personal way. We might even be funny sometimes. We haven't really been funny today, but that might happen in future podcasts. And it's also an opportunity for us to give a voice to other people in the organization. There are a lot of people we work with at other organizations. I've already mentioned some of them today, the Center for Democracy and Technology, EFF. There are other people that we work with all the time that we think ought to be heard from. And there really is no podcast today that covers tech policy.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of podcasts out there that deal with, you know, consumer electronics and gadgets. But I think one space that we're in a unique position to fill is what are the policies that govern those gadgets? And how does what happens in Washington affect the smartphone you're holding in your hand? Well, this brings us to our last segment, which will surely become everyone's favorite segment. We're calling it Tech Derp. Did someone in the world of tech policy say or do something silly recently? A website, DSL Reports, which shows you about how forward-thinking they are, recently ran a piece about the AT&T DirecTV merger. Now, listeners might or might not be aware that the two companies have merged. The author of this piece is very concerned that consumers might be confused as to whether they're going to end up with AT&T TV or DirecTV TV, and that the merged company might be deliberately trying to mislead consumers and trick them. We would just say to the author, have you ever considered that a consumer could walk outside his house, look on top of the roof and say, hey, is there a satellite dish there? That might help answer that question. But that's it for today's show. Thank you for listening to the first of what will hopefully be many tech policy podcasts, assuming we aren't canceled immediately. Until next time.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit, tax-exempt think tank based in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work in tech policy and for more episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.